All right. Thank you, Katie. Is there a pointer?
Not that I know of.
Okay. That's okay.
I'm sorry.
No worries. I meant to ask you before and I forgot. Okay, thank you. Thanks, Katie. I'm happy to be here. Today I'm going to share a brief summary of Zika surveillance data collected by the New York City Department of Health for 2016, and then highlight some interesting findings. So for those of you who haven't gotten enough Zika already, here's some more. So just for some background, New York City Department of Health, we're a local health department that serves a population of 8.5 million people. 1.8 million of those are persons who were born in a Zika-affected country or territory. We have about 60 hospitals, 39 of those that handle deliveries, and approximately 120,000 babies or more are born each year. And then in addition to our residents, we receive millions of passengers each year from Zika-affected areas. Historically, we see imported mosquito-borne diseases among New York City residents, and we investigate hundreds of cases of dengue, chikungunya, malaria each year, and we even investigated a case of Zika back in 2013, and at that point, we had actually advised the patient to abstain from sexual activity for 2 weeks before we knew more. Our Zika response was similar to probably every other jurisdiction that's represented here. We made lab testing available as there was no commercial testing. We were lucky in that our state lab offered Zika testing, including PRNT. We investigated our cases. We monitored pregnant women and infants, educated providers. You know, this was an emerging virus, and there was very limited information available, informing the public, and then preparing for the possibility of local transmission given the presence of Aedes albopictus in New York City. We were fortunate to receive additional city funding as well as CDC funding to hire staff to work on Zika. Our team gradually evolved over time to include 7 new staff that were dedicated to Zika. It was made up of 2 surveillance staff, 2 data staff, dedicated pregnancy coordinated with 4 dedicated staff to investigate and monitor our pregnant cases, and then also to work collaboratively with 3 MDs, 2 of whom were dedicated staff, and this was to work at the time of delivery to obtain infant specimens as well as placental tissue and get more information about the infants, and then also to monitor these babies through the first year of their life. And then in addition, for about a year, we had what we called our Zika testing call center, and this was to manage all the test requests that were coming in and to arrange specimen collection and transport by courier to our public health lab. And then when we were activated for many months, we also had hundreds of other folks within the health department who also contributed to this enormous effort. We had a lot of staff working on this and a lot of travelers. So what did we find? So in 2016, we identified 739 symptomatic cases. Most of these cases were cases that were reported by ARVONET. But then in addition to that, we had all the asymptomatic cases like many of you also had. So we had 274 asymptomatics. Many of these were, or almost all of these were pregnant cases, so not reported through ARVONET. For our total of 1,013 cases. So this is the data that I'm going to use throughout the course of this presentation. And then of those, we had 353 pregnant women that were reported to the pregnancy registry. And I had thought that was a lot of women until I saw the presentations by Puerto Rico and the other U.S. territories. So for all of our cases, I'm breaking it down. You can see, again, the 1,013 breaking apart. There's 353 pregnant women and 660 non-pregnant. About 35% of those were pregnant. And then there was more women than men in the non-pregnant, not surprisingly. And the median age was really kind of the only big difference. For pregnant women, it was 28, and then for non-pregnant, it was 39. Did I miss a slide? I feel like I missed my epi curve. Oh, yeah, there we go. So this is our EpiCurve for 2016, and you can see beginning in June and then going through August, we were getting between 45 and 60 cases per week, which was keeping us very busy. All right, there we go. So looking at our symptomatic cases, and again, I'm really sorry I don't have a pointer here to kind of direct you to where to look. Oh, that is so great. Thank you. Ask and you shall receive. Maybe I'm holding it the wrong way. That's okay. I'll get distracted. Okay, so among the symptomatic cases, and again, looking at the left for all of our cases, all total, it seemed that macular papular rash was reported most commonly. This was followed by arthralgia. Arthralgia's fever, and then conjunctivitis. And then when we broke it apart by our pregnant women and our non-pregnant cases, it was very similar. Rash followed by arthralgia, fever, and conjunctivitis. Similar to most of our other travel-associated diseases, the number one reported reason for travel among our Zika cases was to visit family and friends. Less commonly, it was what was reported was tourism, followed by owning a second home, and then business. And again, it was common when you break it down among the pregnant and the non-pregnant. Formatting seemed to change on this. So where did the cases travel? So this map is actually color-coded to show the neighborhoods where people who were born in Zika-affected areas live within New York City. So from this, you might be able to predict where we might see cases, knowing that most of our cases were traveling to visit friends and family. So if you look, you can kind of, up here we have a large population of folks from the Dominican Republic, Jamaica, Puerto Rico, Guyana. So when you look at where our cases reported travel, looking at the top five, again, all cases, Dominican Republic, Jamaica, followed by Puerto Rico, Trinidad and Tobago, and Guyana. When we broke it apart by pregnant and non-pregnant, it was similar, except for our pregnant cases, we saw far fewer pregnant women reporting travel to Puerto Rico. We're not quite sure what that is, but interesting finding. And then kind of looking at a different kind of graph, it just shows a different way of looking at our cases by area of travel over time. So you can see the country outbreaks within the larger outbreak. So here is our folks who reported travel to the DR in the pink here, Guyana in blue here, Jamaica in the darker tan, and Puerto Rico in the lighter tan. We asked only of our non-pregnant cases questions about prevention measures and risk factors for infection. 16% reported receiving any pre-travel medical advice. Most people, not surprisingly, did report mosquito bites. And we were surprised these numbers were so high. Actually, about 51% reported using bug repellent and 21% reported using a bed net. We identified 11 cases of sexual transmission. Two of these ended up being female-to-male transmission. And in both these cases, the woman was PCR positive and reported having unprotected sex around the time of illness onset, so probably peak viremic period. But also what was interesting in that in both instances, there was mention of blood during intercourse due to menstruation. And we think we probably were able to find these cases because as part of our case investigation, we asked the case patients if they had unprotected sex during or since their illness, and if so, if their partner went on to develop any Zika-like illness. So we were able to find these two cases, interview the partner, and pursue testing. We found six cases of patients with Guillain-Barré syndrome, four of whom reported no preceding Zika-like illness, and surprisingly, only three positive blood donors. So among our 353 pregnant women who delivered, we had 21 infants with laboratory evidence of Zika virus infection, and 12 infants with congenital birth defects consistent with Zika virus. I'm not going to spend too much time on this because my colleague, Dr. Ellen Lee, will be presenting on her congenital cases tomorrow at 2 p.m. if you are interested in hearing more. And then looking more closely at our pregnant women, we had about, well, we found that nearly half of them looked like they had traveled after becoming pregnant. This is based on looking at their last menstrual period relative to the date that they reported leaving New York City. So, you know, we included those who traveled 30 or more days after their last menstrual period. So it is possible that for some of the women included here, it may have been so early in their pregnancy that they may not have known or been aware of their status. And as we described earlier, for most of our cases, reported travel to the DR, Jamaica, Guyana, and most of them were going to visit friends and family. So looking at our method of diagnosis of our cases, PCR, or NAT, was used for to diagnose 664 of our cases versus serology for 323. Urine PCR was the most useful test. It was positive for 477 of our cases, or 45% of our cases, so looking at the urine alone in addition to the serum and urine. Using serology, only 26 of our cases could be confirmed based on a PRNT that was positive to Zika and negative to dengue. But most, probably similar to all of yours, most of those ended up being PRNT positive to both dengue and Zika, so most of them were undifferentiated flavivirus infections. So in New York, pregnant women were offered testing outside of the recommended windows for both PCR and IgM testing. And through that, we identified 22 women who were serum PCR positive more than 14 days after their onset or travel. The median number of days from onset or exposure to diagnosis was about 39 days. And there was another 3 women who were urine PCR positive beyond the 14 days. I don't have the median for that. And then we had, for serology, so for IgM, we had 41 women who were IgM positive beyond the 12-week window. And the median number of weeks from onset or exposure to diagnosis was 18 weeks for those women. So toward the end of 2016, we were pushing providers to test patients using commercial labs. With some exceptions, most notably infants, we still recruit all of our infant testing through our public health lab. And so this graph shows the number of tests performed at our public health laboratory and our state lab in blue. And then over time, you can see decreasing number of tests being done at that lab. The data for the commercial labs is not complete, as, you know, we're not confident that we're receiving all the negative results that are coming in, but it does give you a sense of the increasing number of tests being done at the commercial labs. And so as a result of all the commercial testing, we don't have as much control over who's getting tested and what type of tests are being ordered, and it's proving to be quite a tedious task to try and figure out for all of these women what the epi is and what the labs mean, and then trying to get more lab testing done to better interpret what's going on. So what we did find, it did bring up some issues, and so I'm sure all of you are familiar, but under the EUA agreement, all specimens that are positive at a commercial lab have to be forwarded to our state lab for additional testing. And so for IgM positive specimens, our state lab was repeating that IgM in addition to doing the PRNT. And so we found 40 patients for whom they were Zika IgM positive at a commercial lab, but then the additional testing at our state lab found that half of them actually had no evidence of Zika virus infection. And so for 10 of these, they were negative across the board. So IgM negative, PRNT negative to Zika, PRNT negative to dengue, and then another 11 who were IgM negative, PRNT negative to Zika, but PRNT positive to dengue. We had more faith in our state lab's IgM than we did of the commercial labs, so we attribute this to probably an old dengue infection. So we ended up sending out a health alert to providers, a reminder what they should be doing already, but constant reminder to always wait for PRNT results before making any decisions about pregnancy management. And then more recently, we've been looking at our PCR data. You know, we always considered PCR to be the more reliable test, but we started to notice serum PCR results were discordant between the commercial lab and our lab. And this is only referring to serum, and we just assumed that was due to the multiple freeze-thaw cycles that were going on and viral or RNA degradation. But then You know, as the more cases that we looked at, we noticed that some of them actually had no risk factors, limited risk factors, and in some instances, extended viremic periods. Most of the cases did not have an IgM done, and so we worked hard to try and get additional testing for some of these cases. We identified 8 cases where IgM was available, or we were able to obtain it through additional test requests. And these were 8 cases for which they were PCR positive, but the IgM was negative at a time when it really should have been positive. And so we, based on the zero or limited risk factors and the lack of an IgM, we think these are probably false PCRs. So we're looking more closely at this data, and we'll probably send out another HAN. Again, the same message to providers. It's really important to screen, identify who to test, and what kind of test to order. And remember, you know, always use that IgM when indicated. So moving forward, looking at our data, our case count is lower this year compared to last year. I think at this point in time, we were well over 200 cases, and we're about 70 cases so far this year. Continue to remind clinicians and the public that Zika continues to circulate. Hope for better diagnostic options, like all of you, I assume, and a vaccine. Continue to remind providers to test appropriately, and continue to spend a lot of our time micromanaging cases with odd lab results and our clinical findings. Thank you.
So we have time for questions for Sally. And I have a really big question. So we have continued to do, to ask for all specimens from pregnant women as well as infants to come to our state laboratory because we don't really trust the commercial labs. And so I guess my question is, how much follow-up do you do on commercial lab results that you receive to figure out whether or not it's a pregnant woman and they were tested appropriately? Or did you just give up?
No, we have not given up yet, but it has become quite burdensome. So it's hard to know. You know, we were talking about this and trying to figure out what it all means. But, you know, it's kind of like a shifting in the burden of work, right? So it was really hard for our lab to keep up with all those specimens that were coming in. And, you know, we needed that Zika testing call center to help manage that because we can't take that on. And, you know, the call center's gone, and it would be too much for us to do. Question is, are we spending more time doing the follow-up than what we were doing before? Probably not, but now we are doing all of the work. We haven't quantified it exactly, but yeah, it's a very good question. If the ultimate if what you're trying to get at is, should you move to commercial labs? I can't tell you the answer.
Thanks, Sally. I'm James Wong from the California Department of Public Health. And I wondered if you could say a little bit more about your pregnant patients who traveled. You mentioned they were traveling to visit friends and families, and I'm just wondering, it's a question we've been asking ourselves, whether they received prevention messaging, why they decided to travel, even if they knew that there might be a risk, or maybe they didn't know.
It's a great question, and I don't know that we have very good answers. I mean, we have done some focus groups to try and get at it, and it seems that probably a combination of things, societal pressure. You know, there's family that they feel the need to attend to or visit. Seems that maybe the messaging's not getting to them for some. Some believe that the outbreak is over in their, you know, country that they want to go to. So I think it's a mixture of things, and I don't know that it's concrete for it seems like it may be a little bit different for each individual country of origin, but it's a really good question, and I feel like maybe some of the societal issues are the biggest pressure for some of them.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Hi, Hannah from Washington. The discordant PCR results that you're seeing, are you able to say whether those are results from a single laboratory or from a single lab test?
That's a really good question.
Or is it just over-tested?
It does seem like it's one lab in particular, yeah. But we have to look more closely at our data, but it does seem like it's one lab.
And that lab actually just changed its test.
Ah.
Hey, I'm Amanda from Georgia.
I had a question about the false positive reports. Are you guys having commercial labs send you sample to retest mm-hmm. in addition and to testing like the patient again? And with the lab sending you samples, are you guys getting them pretty quickly? We're having some trouble with that. So I guess that's
yeah.
why I asked that question.
So it seems like it was far more cumbersome and not straightforward in the beginning. It's far more streamlined, but the turnaround time seems to be about 10 days before we'll get the follow-up. So the lab automatically forwards the specimen. Sometimes it's done in batch, goes to our state lab. State lab is able to run those tests very quickly in terms of turnaround. For the PCR and the IgM, PRNT is always going to take some extra time. So our lab will always do a repeat IgM and then the PRNT. If a PCR was ordered, they'll only do PCR. But what we can do, we have two options, right? So we can call the provider and say, you know, it's really important, you should get your patient in and get another IgM because we want them to remember and learn how to order tests appropriately. But there's a lot of cases where time is of the essence, and so we can take that specimen that's already at the lab and order ourselves IgM and PRNT testing if there's enough specimen available. Does that answer your question?
So I guess with us, with the PCRs, maybe it's because our numbers are pretty low, so they don't send them to us regularly, but when we're trying to follow up on a PCR positive that doesn't make sense, it's taking a long time to get the commercial lab to send it to us, mm-hmm. and sometimes they're actually sending it to the wrong place, even though we're like constantly touching base with them almost every day.
Yeah. So I mean, in the beginning when we were having that problem, we were just calling the provider and saying, just get another specimen on your patient and send it for IgM yeah. and PCR.
We've been doing that as well, and mm-hmm. that's been the most successful thing that I was wondering.
Yeah. I know. It's like, how long can you keep it up?
I know. Yeah. Yeah. I know. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sally.
Yeah, you're welcome.